I've been walking a tightrope between fact and fiction. Been wrestling with demons in small bottled prisons. Been talking to sinners who claim to be Christian. Been shouting at leaders who claim to be listening. And the pendulum swings, but I can't stop the pull. Our elections are travesties paid for in full by a gang full of sellouts who worship a bull. Why can't it all just be free and equal?
Hi, I'm Christina Tobin. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Free and Equal Network. Today, I'm very happy to have with us Mr. G. Edward Griffin. He is, well, you may know of the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. And Mr. Griffin, welcome. Thank you for coming on today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Christina. It's my pleasure.
I've really been looking forward to this interview, I would say the most thus far. And I've learned so much about the Federal Reserve in the last 6 months of my life. And I wanted, I guess, just to start off for our listeners who may not be familiar with you, I think most of them are, but those who are not, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, where a bit about The Creature from Jekyll Island and what really allured you to write such a powerful book?
Well, sure. I'm sure that that's an important thing to get into the record, but it's, you know, who I am or my experiences and the stuff I've written, probably not as important as some of these topics. But still, in a nutshell, I'm just a writer. And I started writing books back in, well, I guess my first book was published in 1964. And I've had an interest in controversial topics, usually upstream topics, topics which I consider to be important, not just to me, but to the community and to the world. It's kind of a grandiose view. I've always had kind of a crusader instinct, I suppose. And so I tackled the big topics. And so I've written about, my first book was about the United Nations. It was a critical review of the UN. I wrote about the Supreme Court, another critical review of what was going on back in the Warren Court era. I've written a biography. I've written, of course, about health. One book in particular called World Without Cancer was about a non-toxic, non-drug approach to the cancer problem. And then the one that seems to have caught a lot of attention recently is the one called The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is a second look at the Federal Reserve System. And that one, of course, is the one that seems to be more popular, especially today, because we can see the economy unwinding. We can see all of the fraud and the scams that are involved with the banking system, and the monetary system is coming unglued. So that issue seems to be uppermost in people's minds because it's hitting their pocketbook. So I'm just a writer. I'm a researcher. I get into these things, and I like to take my time in researching them so that even though I start out pretty much as a blank slate, by the time I reach the end of it, I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on this, and I'm ready to tackle the best of them with debates. And so that's my life. I guess I've written a lot of controversial stuff, but I consider it to be important information, and I feel good about what I'm doing.
It's, for me, one of the most important topics. Thank you for giving an overall description of what you've done. I know that you actually were a child actor and a radio station manager before the age of 20. I read on your Wikipedia page.
Well, <Yeah. laughs> I was a kid actor. There's no question about that, in especially in radio back in Detroit. But that bit about, I don't know where that came about being a radio station manager. I've never done that. I've worked in a lot of radio stations, but I've never been a manager. So anyway, it doesn't make any difference. I've been in the field of communications most of my life.
Well, you sound like that, you know, everyday guy that just writes what he thinks, and definitely you've done your homework, and the credibility our supporters, so many, have been really eager to have you on the Free and Equal Network. And so, and in all seriousness, I, I've been a huge advocate for ballot access, getting candidates on the ballot and moderating debates and stuff like that through free and equal elections. But it wasn't until really last November that, I became way more experienced and I guess just awake when it comes to learning about the Federal Reserve System. And when I was invited to keynote at an In the Fed rally out in Little Rock, Arkansas, dozens of people and all of the media showed up, and I just learned how, wow, there is really a correlation between the Commission on Presidential Debates and the Federal Reserve. Really seem to be both tools used by the elite to control the system. Is that correct?
Well, certainly. The elite, it's all about control, isn't it? Otherwise, they don't stay elite very long. That seems to be like the primary directive of the elite. In order to keep in that spot, you have to control that huge, unwieldy mass of people out there, keep them content with whatever situation they have, and keep them from learning too much so that they don't try and make any changes. So it's all about control, yes.
And, the two-party system, here at Free and Equal, we're here to not only break the stranglehold of the two-party system, but, to fix things, to reform the electoral system. And, this two-party system and just, putting the pieces together is controlled by the central banks. The Federal Reserve, as most of our listeners know, is a private institution created in 1913 and really run by the Rothschild banking cartel. And it just... until we actually, put the Federal Reserve out of business, it seems. The same with the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is run by the former chair of the Democratic Republican Party. I mean, the money pumped into that is from the elite as well. Until we actually put an end or bypass, that is, the Federal Reserve, Commission on Presidential Debates, and so on, we're going to continue having the problems that we have. And I guess that gets to my first question. I guess we'll just hit the Rothschild point first, the role. Can you tell us a little bit more about the role of the Rothschilds in the history of central banking?
Well, the Rothschild name, of course, is synonymous with central banking. Its origins were in Europe, and the Rothschild family were the prime movers in developing that institution. The first manifestation of it in any great form was the Bank of England. And perhaps it's necessary to define a few terms, because we who have been splashing around in this terminology forget that a lot of people don't know what it means when you say a central bank. What does that mean? Is it really a bank? It's certainly central, but is it a bank? And the answer is no. This institution that was developed by the Rothschilds and other banking dynasties as well, I mean, it wasn't just the Rothschilds, it was a European phenomenon and involved several banking families. The Warburgs were there, and I mean, there were others. And by the way, the Warburgs were very instrumental in the creation of the Federal Reserve System here in the United States. But in any event, this institution called central banking is deceptive in terms of its name, because it tends to make you think that it is, in most cases, people think it's an agency of the government to which it's attached. But in reality, a central bank is nothing but a banking cartel. It's a cartel of banks, or in some cases only one bank, but usually more than one bank, and they're privately owned, privately run, they're independent of government, and yet they're so powerful and financially influential that they are able to literally buy their way into control of the various governments. Politicians, unfortunately, tend to be for sale. It's not, sometimes not so obvious, but when it comes down to running for office, politicians know that they need lots of money, especially in the modern world. They need very well-heeled campaign donors. They need corporate support. And they especially need support from the media. Well, it turns out that the banking industry also is very influential, or I should say very dominant, in controlling the media as well. Money controls a lot of things, including the media. So politicians become very, very let's say, dependent upon support from this banking community, this industry. They know that they're not going to be elected or reelected if they fall into disfavor with the banking dynasties that control their nation. So when we speak of central banking, we're really speaking of a hidden financial control over governments. And they form a partnership between the banks and the governments. And the governments usually pass a law or a series of laws in which they transfer to the private banks of their nation the authority, the power to create the nation's money in the name of the nation. It's kind of a sleight of hand trick because the average person doesn't understand it. All he knows is that the money looks like it's issued by the government. You take the American dollar, for example, it's got all the pictures of presidents of the United States on it. It's got the Treasury seal on it. It says the word United States is very dominant on it. But you notice it doesn't say just the United States, or it doesn't say the United States Treasury. It just says the Federal Reserve System underneath it. Then that's really what it is. The money, even though it says United States on it and has the Treasury seal on it and all of that, it's really issued not by the government at all. It's issued by the Federal Reserve, which is the reason that the money now says Federal Reserve Note. Well, how did this happen? How come that the, now let's just talk about America, how come the American monetary system is actually created by the banks and not by the government? Well, therein lies a long tale. And it was Rothschild himself, it was Nathan Rothschild years ago, who is attributed as having said, let me control the issuance of the nation's money, and I care not who passes its laws. Implying, of course, that he can buy those people with the money that he creates. Well, that's really the name of the game. So when you start talking about central banks and you talk about the Federal Reserve System in particular in this country, you're really talking about a system in which the private banking industry has very quietly and very gradually acquired control of the entire government. Now, the United States is completely dominated by the banking industry. And we think it's the other way around. Most people think, well, the government controls the banks, when in reality, the shocking reality is that the banks control the government. And you can see that almost every day in the news. And you wonder, how come Congress dutifully votes to create all of this money, these billions and trillions of dollars? And of course, the Federal Reserve actually does the creation, but the Congress has to approve it. And so Congress approves it. They just vote for it. They don't question where it's going to come from. They know it's not going to come from taxes because there's no way you can collect taxes for that much money. They know it's going to come from inflation. And so they'll just vote for it. And they'll know that the Federal Reserve will create the money out of nothing, dilute the purchasing value of each dollar that's already out there, raise the prices of everything, and that's how the average person pays for it, is through inflation. And so where does that money go? Well, have you noticed? It goes to the banks. It goes to bail out the banks. It goes to bail out the corporations that owe money to the banks so they can continue sending their interest payment to the banks. If you follow that huge cash flow that is originating in Washington since 2008, the trillions of dollars, it goes primarily, directly and indirectly, it goes to the banks, to the banks, to the banks. And some people are confused by that, and that's only because they do not understand the reality that our central bank, called the Federal Reserve System, is nothing but a banking cartel. It's no different than a banana cartel or an oil cartel. It's just a banking cartel, and they have purchased control of the United States government.
You've got my heart racing, goosebumps too. The quote there you had from Rothschild says it all. And, you know, I looked up another quote from the Rothschild Brothers of London that says, "The few who understand the central bank system will either be so interested from its profits or so dependent on its favors that there will be no opposition from that class."
That's it. It's just... Yeah, the people who know, well, most of them are involved in it, and they're doing very well, thank you. They don't want to change it. Well, people like you and I know about it, but we're not involved in it, and we wouldn't want to be. I mean, it might be tempting to be on the gravy train, but when you think it through, you realize that the whole thing is based on fraud. It's legalized plunder, and so anybody with conscience could not ever participate in that process.
You know, I've had a lot of supporters since I'm a huge advocate on electoral reform, campaign finance. You know, I definitely, there's a lot of problems there, and they're trying a lot of introducing so-called bills for campaign finance. And, you know, you put the logic together. It's like, well, okay, great to have campaign finance reform, but while the Federal Reserve is in existence, I mean, these candidates, you know, are provided unlimited funding, if not indirectly, legally, illegally, who knows, right? Our judicial system's so flawed. But I mean, until we actually look at the heart of the problem, which is the Federal Reserve, until we address that, you know, we're not going to be able to, I feel, you know, fix our system. And that's a huge, you know, thing that we need to address, which gets me to our next question via social media from Jason Geary. And I hope I pronounced that right, Jason. Mr. Griffin, can you see a way in which the United States could successfully move away from the Federal Reserve System while maintaining financial stability?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I might rephrase that question and say that it must move away from the Federal Reserve System in order to regain financial stability. The fact is, it does not have financial stability now. And the reason it does not have financial stability is because of the Federal Reserve System. It's a plundering mechanism. It's not made to create stability. It's made to plunder. And so the only way we can retain or go back to financial stability is to get rid of the plundering mechanism. Now, does that mean that there will not be some severe shudders and shakes and rumbles and earthquakes to the system? Of course there will be. It's just like coming out from a hangover, I suppose would be a good analogy. I mean, the system is so toxic right now with this this system of creating money out of nothing, the central bank system, that returning back to health is going to require a detox process. And a lot of people who are, as you mentioned earlier, already benefiting from the system are going to have to let go of their benefit on behalf of the betterment of the nation. And a lot of those people aren't going to want to do it. They're going to go into the streets. They're going to clamor. They're going to demonstrate. Some of them will riot because they don't want to give up their benefits. They don't want to give up their welfare. They don't want to give up the money that they're getting at the expense of other people. They don't want to give up all their privileges. And so they're going to clamor to keep the system the way it is, or even to make it worse. And they don't care about the other people. So we have to deal with that. And then, of course, a lot of investments that are now artificially pumped up because it favors certain classes of society, which are politically favored. I'm talking about the stock market is artificially supported right now.
Yes.
And also the housing industry is still being artificially supported. And so there are bubbles in those sectors. A lot of people are riding those bubbles and taking advantage of them and thinking, oh boy, this is good. I'm making some money again. They don't realize that all bubbles burst. And so when you go back to a stable system, which is the basis of the question, if you get back to a stable system, which is not plundering one group at the expense of another, and which is not dependent upon bubbles, which eventually must burst, well, then those people who are now in those bubbles are going to go splat. They're not going to like it. And there are a lot of adjustments, in other words, that need to be made. But the basic question is very clear. Yes, if we are going to go back to a economic stable system, we must do it without the Federal Reserve. There's no other way.
Well, let's dig a little deeper. What do you think would happen to the American dollar if, and this is just a thought of my own, American dollar, if nations begin to replace it as the world currency reserve?
Well, if the other nations of the world give up on accepting the American dollar as the reserve currency of the world, and that process is underway as we speak, when that happens, well, then the true value, or I should say the perceived value of the American dollar, will finally meet its true value, which is close to zero. The only real value of the American dollar today lies in the fact that most people are willing to accept it in exchange for goods and services, which take energy to produce. They'll accept that dollar. So that's what gives it its value. Part of the reason they accept it is because of tradition. It's been accepted for a long, long time, and changes are usually very slow in that sector. And another part of the reason is that the military of the United States is still the most powerful in the world. And we found, very sadly so, over the last decade or so, that countries that start talking about not accepting American dollars in trade, especially for the purchase of oil, those countries suddenly get renamed or reclassified as terrorist countries. And we invade them to protect the people against terrorism and to restore democracy or some other made-up excuse. But we always invade those countries and we demonize them. first thing you know, their original decision to abandon the dollar is suddenly reversed and they're back in the fold again. That's how it works. So the question is, what's going to happen to the American dollar when people stop accepting it, other countries stop accepting it? I'll repeat, its perceived value will finally meet its real value, which is very close to zero. And that means bad news for the American people, who over all of these last four or five decades have been having a free ride at the expense of most of the world, because we ship overseas our dollars, our paper dollars, or our inkwell dollars, our computer-generated dollars. They're worthless, but they're just digits in the computer, and we ship them overseas in terms of trillions and trillions. It doesn't cost us anything to create that, and then they ship us their cars and their refrigerators and all of their things that they used human energy to produce. So we got a lot of benefit in this country. We got real things in exchange for nothing. And those countries were glad to receive that nothing, because other people were still willing to accept the nothing. But when that game comes to an end, well, all of a sudden, we Americans will not have that free ride anymore. And all of those dollars that have been shipped overseas will want to come back. We want to come back quickly before they become totally worthless, and so they can buy at least something while the game is still on. So we'll see all those trillions of dollars coming back to America to buy up whatever we can produce, you know, our cars and our real estate, our stocks and our bonds, or buy up our corporations, or buy up a few politicians, whatever's for sale. And all that money will come back, and we will now know inflation like we have never ever known it before. It will become, I am afraid to say, one of the worst inflations that any country has ever seen throughout all of history.
That's consistent with all the fellow leaders that I have been speaking to on a regular basis. And, you know, this gentleman by the name of Dugan King out in Little Rock, he's really become a mentor of mine in learning about the monetary system. And he educated me a bit about the London Exchange of 1815. It was a Rothschild tactic, of which a whole bunch of paper, gold, and silver, which is what is happening now, I've been informed, where the banks are letting go of the paper, gold, and silver all at once and driving the market down. And people are getting scared and thinking, you know, gold and silver is worth nothing, you know, and they're selling it. And then the banks are picking it up and they're buying it at a cheap price. And then next thing you know, the banking system has almost all the actual gold and silver. And then suddenly the dollar collapses. That's correct, right? That's the tactic that's being used right now.
Well, it's true that some of the banks are acquiring it, and some are selling it. The main central bank that's selling gold and silver happens to be the Federal Reserve. It's the most stupid thing in the world in terms of American interests. We mustn't forget that a banking cartel doesn't give a darn about American interests. They only care about their own interests.
True. And
they're doing this to keep the game going a little bit longer. You must understand that this process of monetizing debt, That's how they phrase it. It's converting IOUs into money and then putting the money into circulation. It's a Ponzi scheme. And it makes Murdoch look. Matt, what's this fellow? This Ponzi guy, Madoff or whatever his name
Murdoch,
was.
Murdoch, yeah.
Yeah, Madoff or whatever. Anyway, it makes him look like a little two-bit player. You know, he's nothing compared to what's going on at the higher levels of Washington and at the Federal Reserve System. It's a Ponzi scheme, and they keep having to create more and more money in order to pay off the other people, so that they, you know, so that the game can be played a little bit longer and bring new people into the net. Well, this cannot go on forever. And I'm glad you mentioned the difference between paper gold and real gold. I think people should understand that the spot price of gold that we read about in the newspaper is a totally fictitious price. It's not the real price of gold. It's the price of paper gold. The real gold, if you want to go down and take delivery of it and get it in your hot hand as you turn over your Federal Reserve notes and the guy gives you the gold right there on the spot across the counter, you cannot buy gold or silver at those spot prices today. Nobody in their right mind that actually has the real stuff is going to let loose of it at that price. The only thing you can get is these contracts, these little pieces of paper. That's why they call it paper gold. It's a contract. It's an agreement. It's a promise to deliver you gold at some time in the future. It's a promise that is made by a group of liars who do not have the gold or the silver at all. They just don't have it. And what they're counting on, and what you must understand when you buy this contract, is that you're saying, okay, if the price goes up or the price goes down, it doesn't make a difference, at some future time, you will deliver that gold or silver to me, or at least deliver the dollars to me that is the price of that gold or silver. So you see, they're planning to deliver the dollars, not the real gold or silver. The gold or silver, I don't even know why it's mentioned in the contract. It doesn't exist. It's just a speculation. It's like going to a casino and just betting that the little ball will land on red or black. You know, you can bet on the roulette table all you want, and fortunes can be made, but nobody takes home the little white ball. Well, nobody takes home the gold or the silver in the futures market. And all this spot price of gold and silver is all futures. It's all speculative. There's no gold or silver involved. It's just a big speculation game at the casino. The real price of gold and silver is not even close to that today. And if you want to satisfy yourself on that, just go down to your coin store and say, I want to buy a gold coin, and see what the price is.
So if somebody has money, I mean, given today's drop in the value of gold and silver, should people keep their metals or should they get out of the market?
Well, it depends on what they want to do. If they need the money, and that's one of the reasons people acquire gold and silver, is as a storehouse of value. And there comes a time in most people's lives where they need to liquidate. That certainly happened to me a couple of times in my life. I remember when I was relatively young, I went to Las Vegas when they started issuing these phony coins. And, you know, prior to that, they were all silver. The quarters and half dollars and dimes were real silver. And then they started to issue the phony ones. So my wife and I went to Las Vegas, and we spent a whole weekend one time. And we'd go into the casinos, and we'd buy up, you know, $20 or $50 worth of coins to supposedly play in the slot machines. And then we take them up to the hotel room, spread them all out on the bed, sort out the real silver, and put the junk coins all back in a bowl, and take the junk coins back down to the gal in the little booth and say, here, we want our money back now for these. And then we go to another place and get some more coins and all of that, you know. So And then I had these bags of coins that I thought, boy, I was really pretty smart. And then I had a reversal in my business a few years later, and I needed the money. So out came the coins, and I took the coins down and sold them. So if a person needs to liquidate, then that's the deciding factor. But if you don't need to liquidate, my view is that silver and gold or other precious metals are the best storehouse of value you can possibly have in a inflationary economy. So unless you really need to liquidate them, my opinion is that you should just hang on to them. Whether the price goes up or down, just hang on to them, because you know that they're in the long run, they're going to preserve your purchasing power. You may not make money on it. That's not the deal. That's not why you should be acquiring gold or silver, is to make a profit on it. Your primary objective is just to maintain your savings, so maintain the purchasing power of the money that you've earned. Now, you may make some money, or you may lose a little money depending on the psychology of the market at the particular time you're buying or selling, but those movements are usually relatively small. On the long run, if you just back off and look at the charts for 5 and 10 years, you'll see that those graphs are pretty predictable. You can tell that in the long run, if you're hanging on to gold or silver, you will not lose your purchasing power.
Yeah, definitely. And learning the history again of the London Exchange of 1815, when the banks of basically, as they started to gather all of the actual gold and silver, suddenly, the system collapsed. And some say that that's the objective, to collapse the U.S. dollar, and then world order allegedly comes into effect, and there's a world dominant currency. And for me, I guess I would personally hold on to the gold and silver. It seems like historically it will be very, very valuable. I couldn't agree with you more. That would be a better better thing to do. And I like to focus a lot on solutions. we know all of the problems, and we're really solution-based movement here at Free and Equal and Building Others. And I wanted to get your feel. I'm really interested in this question. It comes actually from Dugan King at Little Rock, Arkansas, and about alternative currencies like Berkshires, Mountain Hours, and Bitcoin. I know there's several months ago I read an article that there were 37 states in the process or had introduced alternative currency throughout the U.S. What's your take on alternative currencies? Are there specific ones you support?
Well, I like alternative currencies simply because they're alternatives.
I figured.
The one we've got, the Federal Reserve notes are about as bad as they can get. So it seems a alternative would be preferable. But of course, that's not true. Some alternatives are not as good as others. Just because it's alternative doesn't make it good. But although most alternative currencies can serve a very valuable function at the local level if the community is relatively small. But the problem with most of the alternative currencies that I have seen is that they too are basically fiat. In other words, there's nothing of intrinsic value behind them. Although some people say, well, this is worth an hour of labor. Well, an hour of labor, if one man's hour of labor is not the same as another man's hour of labor. And how do you put a meter on your labor? You know, is an hour of hard work, or is an hour of easy work, and so forth. To me, I will always prefer a currency that has intrinsic value. Now, gold and silver certainly have intrinsic value, but there are other things that do. I mean, if you wanted to have a currency based on diamonds, you could. But the problem is, you'd have to be a diamond expert in order to really know the value of the currency that you were exchanging. You'd have to, devote your life to being an expert in that field. So that's not a very good currency. You could buy a warehouse full of cheap white wine, I suppose, and use bottles of wine for barter to buy things or exchange for things. And that would probably work fairly well, but not as good as a piece of paper or a gold coin or a silver coin. But there are all kinds of variables. But to answer your question, I personally have an affinity for something that has intrinsic value, that is, has all of the qualities of a precious metal, which they can be divided, they don't lose their value, they can be measured by almost anybody, their purity can be measured, their weight can be measured, they can be melted down into little pieces, they can be melted together into big pieces, they don't go away, they last for thousands of years, they don't deteriorate, and so forth. A lot of qualities of precious metals that have made them universally accepted as currency throughout history. Those qualities, I think, should be not overlooked. Most alternative currencies do not have those qualities. Bitcoin is an interesting recent example. But it too, they say it's absolutely limited in quantity, and therefore the value must continually go up. But it's dependent upon electronic communications. It's dependent upon the internet. It's dependent upon ability to people to theorize how many bitcoins there are in somebody's account. You can't hold them. You can't put them in a can. you can't put them under your mattress. You can't give them to somebody physically and so forth. And I worry
Sounds
about
like
that.
Tried.
Yeah, I worry about that.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I would recommend that people dabble in alternative currencies. I think they're fun, and you might even make some money in some of them. I think it's possible, for example, for people to make some profit with bitcoins as their value goes up. But for the long run, I always go back to gold and silver. I feel more comfortable with that.
Yeah, my dad's a huge fan. My dad, Jim Tobin, out of Chicago, he's been fighting taxes for 35 years, and he has always taught me diversification, you know, is the way to go. Diversify, put a little bit of everything, you know, spread it out. But regarding the gold coins, you know, circulating gold coins is fine, but you know, I've been talking to supporters, you know, they feel like, you know, that circulating paper money backed by gold is counterfeiting unless you're holding 100% of the coins in reserve. In that case, why not just circulate the coins? Why go to the added expense of vaulting the gold and, you know, and printing the paper money? That's just kind of been some questions that I've had.
Well, I agree with that. That's a very good question. And the only answer is convenience and the weight. I mean, if you had, let me just take a number. If you had $5,000 in paper bills, you know, in $100 bills, that would be a stack that you could probably stick in your pocket. But $5,000 in silver coins, pretty heavy. I mean, you'd need, I don't know, I'd have to look at that, but you'd need a couple of big cigar boxes full of coins, maybe a couple of shoe boxes full or more. And they would be very, very heavy. So it's just a question of convenience. And I think that's the reason that the paper bills came into being in the first place.
Yeah, some criticize the gold standard as a phase one of fractional reserve banking counterfeiting, and we are currently in phase two, the fiat phase of fractional reserve banking, which is designed to self-destruct according to the plan. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, fractional reserve banking, of course, is totally wrong.
You might want to explain what that is.
Well, fractional reserve banking. Yeah, it's as you could make a big dissertation on this about its history and all that. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that the definition or the words themselves kind of define what it is. You expect a bank, if they give you a checkbook and they say, okay, you've got $1,000 on deposit here in the bank, and you can write $1,000 in checks, or they can give you $1,000 in currency. Either way, the agreement is, or the understanding is, that somewhere in the bank, in a vault, there's $1,000 in gold or silver, some kind of hard asset that you agree to is to be in reserve. That's what the reserve means. It's the backing behind those checks or paper bills. It's what gives them value. They have no value themselves except for the paper and the ink. But when you say, I promise, as Mr. Big Banker here, I give you my word of honor that we have $1,000 worth of, or so many ounces worth of gold or silver on deposit in our vault in reserve for the time that you may want them in exchange. Now, that's 100% reserve banking. That's the way it should be. It's just logical. But then when the bank says, well, okay, no, we don't need to keep all of that gold in the vault. Most people don't want it. They'll let us keep it. We can start issuing more paper bills and more checks against that reserve than we actually have. Let's suppose we got $1,000 in reserve in silver, and now we issue $2,000 in currency. Now, everybody holding that currency thinks that they can go to the bank and redeem it in full for the silver. Well, it's impossible now, because it's now called fractional reserve banking. They've only got 50% reserve. because they've got $1,000 in silver and $2,000 in money as claims against the silver. And so once you start introducing the concept that it's okay to promise to deliver more silver or gold than you actually have in the vault, that's called fractional reserve banking. It has a lot of advantages for those people who are in the credit business, for people who like to lend money out at interest. You see, just think about that. Instead of just sitting on $1,000 in silver, you can actually print another $1,000 in loans, and let's say issue it as a check in a checking account, and collect interest on $1,000 that you never had. So that's the trick of modern banking. They always collect interest on money that they create out of nothing. Interest on nothing is the name of the game in banking today. So back to the main track. Once you introduce the concept that it's okay to not have 100% backing behind your money, then you're on that slippery slope. And throughout history, it's never stopped at 50% or 40% or 30%. It's always gone eventually to 0%. And that's why I said in my book that fractional reserve banking is merely a transition stage to the real stage, which is fiat money. Fiat money meaning that the money is created out of nothing with nothing of intangible value behind it. It's just a question of time. Once you start into fractional reserve, that you will wind up all the way to the point where the fraction is zero.
Well, yeah, thanks for that description. And again, people do fear that the gold standard is phase one of the fractional reserve banking counterfeiting. I'm learning so much, and they feel we're currently in phase two, which is again the fiat phase of the fractional reserve system, which is designed to self-destruct according to the plan with my thoughts before. And so I wanted to pick your brain a little bit. I've been learning a lot about Benjamin Franklin, and are you familiar with his Pennsylvania script system?
No, I'm not.
It's something I'll definitely send you some information on that. And I just became familiar with this. It's actually recognized as his greatest invention and the greatest monetary system ever devised. And so I definitely am going to send you some information on that. I've also been learning about the London School and the Austrian School of Economics.
Oh, yes. Could I just interrupt for a second and go back to Ben?
Sure, please.
I'm very suspicious of Ben's views on money. He was one of the few of our founding fathers that did not think that we ought to have limits on the ability to create money out of nothing. He was one of the few that said that it's okay for government to issue money based on IOUs. And we must remember that Ben Franklin was a printer. That was his business. And he, in fact, did print money for several of the colonial governments. They just printed up money instead of, collecting it in taxes. And it was a good business for Franklin. So I'm suspicious. I'm very skeptical of any script system that Ben Franklin would come up with. I want to look at it very carefully. I'm going to suspect that it's fiat money.
I'm going to look forward to your response. I mean, the script system, it says here, is a simple accounting method where uniform objects such as beads, seashells, tobacco, coins, or paper notes have been used as tokens of credit to pay and maintain a large workforce. So it doesn't seem as if there's any printing incorporates that. And it says, under the script system, eventually every state will discover that debt and taxation are no longer necessary. So it's all new to me, and I'm taking it all in. And I can't wait to send you the information, tax-free new American money system, and get your feedback on that. So
Well, that's one of the beauties of the Federal Reserve System, and people very high up in that system have said that now that governments can literally create money out of nothing through the Federal Reserve System, that taxes aren't even necessary for revenue. And they made that very clear. The only reason for taxes in their mind today is not to generate revenue at all, because they can create all the revenue they want just by creating the money. They use taxes as a means of controlling the people.
Right.
Taxes as a means of taking from some and giving to others. It's a means of redistributing wealth. It's a means of engineering society. And they were very clear about that. It's a shocking statement the first time you run across it. And then you think about it for a minute and you think, of course, if these guys can create all the money they want out of nothing, why do they need taxes? And that's the answer. It's because they want to control us.
Yeah, and I'm not okay with that. You know, it's, you know, I'm looking up a little more in the script system here. Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy, for example, they both experimented with the tax-free script system during their terms as president. Of course, both experiments mysteriously ended when they their lives were taken away from us. And a question, I've always, you know, I've learned a little bit about JFK's executive order when he attempted to replace the Federal Reserve note issued as a debt with the U.S. Treasury notes issued as a credit, the $2 bill. I mean, do you think, or maybe, I don't even have an answer, JFK's executive order had anything even to do with this assassination. It's just strange, you know, learning and reading books about the real Lincoln and the truth about FDR. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have written on that, and if you're interested in my views, I have quite a long analysis that's posted to the Freedom Force website, which is one of my websites. It's called freedomforceinternational.org, and you'll find it in the issues section, and I think the title of the analysis is called the JFK assassination myth, or the JFK myth, or something like that. But in a nutshell, I do not think that JFK was assassinated even closely because of his issuance of that executive order. I also don't think that JFK even knew what he was signing when he signed that executive order. When you really look into the details, you find out that that executive order was sort of a house cleaning a bill. It was merely transferring authority that already existed from the president to the Secretary of the Treasury. It didn't grant any new powers. It was a little house cleaning thing. And the bills that were printed, those Treasury notes, a few of them actually were printed, and a few of them wound up into collectors' drawers. Most of them were never issued. It was never designed to challenge the Federal Reserve System. JFK was a total internationalist, as much as you can admire him for many, many other qualities. He went to the London School of Economics, which was founded by the Fabian Socialists in England. He was an internationalist. He believed in redistribution of wealth from America, extending our wealth overseas to make all the countries of the world equal. He gave speeches on that. I mean, he was the last guy in the world to challenge the Federal Reserve System.
Yeah.
And the essays that have been going around to make it sound so convincing refer to a speech, for example, that JFK gave at, I guess it was Columbia, I believe it was, in which he made some kind of a cryptic statement about, you know, I must warn the American people about this and so forth. Well, I wrote to Columbia and I said, I'd like to get a copy of this full speech that President Kennedy gave on such a date there at Columbia. Well, I got a letter back from the head of the archives and they said, oh, no, President Kennedy wasn't here on that date. He didn't give a speech here on that date. In fact, we've checked our records and he's never given a speech here at any date. So I said, well, isn't that interesting? So then I wrote to the White House and I asked for their secretarial staff that if they could be good enough to tell me where President Kennedy was on that date. And they wrote back, said, well, he was here in the White House and he had a reception with some ambassadors and he went to a luncheon and such and such. He gave a speech and such and such. He met with so and so. He was there in Washington all this time. And so no matter where I went to run down this story, I was met with a total blank. So I came to the conclusion that, you know, this wasn't exactly good scholarship that came up with that story.
Well, thank you so much for your insight, and I will definitely read that.
I think you'll find it interesting.
I will. I love learning, and I've learned so much from this interview. I just am a sponge, and I am so thankful for your time. I have just a few more questions here, and we'll get on with our day. And
yes.
Just kind of touching the topic of the London School and the Austrian School of Economics, some say seems to be the dialectic twin of the central bankers. But there's something new that's rising, and another school of economics has been swept under the rug by the central bankers, called the American School of Economics. I'm not sure if you know Bill Still, or if you two are friends, or it seems like he does a lot of work in publicizing and spreading the word about what the Federal Reserve is about.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Still?
Yes, I'm familiar with Bill. I've met him. In fact, I've debated Bill a couple of times, once on the platform and continuously on the internet. And my analysis is that Bill has done an excellent job of recounting the hideous history of central banking throughout the world, and including the Federal Reserve. He's done a great job of that. And I'm with him all the way until the very last step in the journey, where he says, okay, what are we going to do about it? And his Bill's solution to fiat money throughout history is to create new fiat money. I couldn't believe it when I came to that.
Interesting.
Yeah, he believes that all we need to do is create new fiat money. This time, just get the bankers out of it. And as long as it's just done by the government, the Treasury, he feels that we can, you know, those nice, trustworthy politicians, that'll make it fine. Well, I don't care whether fiat money is created by politicians or bankers. It'll corrupt either of them. And it, in fact, history shows that it has. So anyway, we part company on that last step in the journey. I don't think the solution to fiat money is more fiat money.
That sounds very logical. I'm going to look up that debate too. That'll be an interesting one on top of your study research on Kennedy. And the American School of Economics, Bill Still and others are at the forefront of bringing it to public attention. Is really American school is where you do away with the fractional reserve banking and favor an honest script system. So here we are back at script. And I guess, again, I'm going to send you that information, the script system that is as a credit instead of a debt. So I definitely will follow up with you shortly after our interview with that information.
Yes, I'd be glad to see it. But I can smell it coming. It's
new
fiat
to me
money.
Too. Okay.
it's fiat money under a different name. That's all.
New to me. I thank you for your insight. I value that. And I wanted to end the interview on a light question. Sean McDowell, it's a cute question. Can you ask Mr. Griffin who he voted for in the last election and why?
Who I voted for? I presume they're talking about the presidential position.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, I voted for Ron Paul.
Nice.
Well, I'm an old-fashioned guy. I believe that you should vote for the person who represents the principles that you hold. I don't think that you should vote for somebody because he has a better chance of winning. I think you should vote for somebody because he thinks like you do. I think you should put your vote in wherever it expresses your views, not the views of some political party or some pundit in the news, or just because somebody has a better chance of winning. I mean, winning.
Really supported Ron Paul. I mean, obviously he didn't make it on the 2012, the RNC was kicked out.
Yeah, well,
the party they'd rather crash the party than let somebody else in, and that's why free and equal wages parties are.
Yeah. You can write candidates in, but I would never let me.
Oh, you wrote them in.
Yeah. So
cool.
Yeah. Why not? I think on the backside of that, another way of asking that same question is, should you vote for somebody if you don't think they represent your point of view? And I think, no, you shouldn't. And therefore, I would rather not vote at all for any candidate than vote for a candidate who represents principles which I abhor. Just because I think he has a chance of winning? No, I lose if I vote for somebody who represents principles that I disagree with. I would never do that. It's insane. I would rather leave the ballot blank.
That's something I 100% agree with you on. I sometimes feel that it's difficult for me to even vote within a system that's flawed, and it is flawed. And I feel that the two-party system leads us to believe that our vote counts when, in fact, it really Some say don't, but you know, I like to focus on the future and when we fix the system and we have a huge, powerful movement of people and the movement we're doing. And I think you're familiar with, we're actually holding a United We Stand Festival, Free and Equal, that is at UCLA on October 12th at the Pauley Pavilion, and is where where it's going to be. And I'm really excited about the event because it's a kickoff for a 10-stop university bus tour. We're going to have 3 stops next February, March, April. But there's a solution to this. The kids are going to come out in full force as 18 to 28-year-olds and run mm-hmm. for local office beginning in 2014. Mm-hmm. And we're going to list them through a national open source database, all mm-hmm. the candidates running. We're going to have open debates locally. We're going to bring the power back to the people locally and mm-hmm. Be involved and engaged in our voting process so our vote really does count. So for people who haven't voted in the past, I don't hold it against them. And I understand why. For me, I just couldn't be a part of a system that's flawed. But in the future, if they don't vote, I will definitely hold it against them because we are going to fix it. We really are. And I want to personally, invite you to be a part of that festival. Jesse Ventura will be there, 3-time Emmy Award winning Amber Lyon journalist, Dr. Jill Stein, the list goes on. Larry Pratt, Executive Director of Gun Owners of America, Sean Stone, Oliver Stone's son. I mean, it's a great Peter Joseph, the founder of Zeitgeist Movement, Sheriff Mack. Talk about constitutional sheriff right there that makes the difference. And so I wholeheartedly invite you to be a part of this epic event because I need an expert on the monetary system, and you are it.
Well, thank you. I'm anxious to learn more about it, and I know you're going to put together a great show. I wish you the best of success with it.
Thanks for your consideration, and thank you for your time today.
And you're very welcome.
And I look forward to learning more about you and interviewing with you in the future and continuing on. And you have a great day.
All right. Thank you. Same to you, Christina. Bye.
Thank you so much, Edward. Been listening to the Free and Equal Network. Thank you so much for joining us today.